100 years ago, the Representation of the People Act was passed, which gave some women the right to vote in UK general elections for the very first time. The focus on early female suffrage campaigners in the UK tends to centre on the actions of the suffragettes in the capital. But the path to the voting rights we enjoy today has a much more complicated story. It was a national movement, fought by women and men of all classes, people of all ages and in locations right across the UK. People who lived and worked at places now in the care of the National Trust were also involved and influential throughout the campaign. This year, right across the Trust, properties are delving into their archives for the stories of people who took part in or bore witness to these momentous events. In this five-part series, you'll hear from house stewards, curators, volunteers and experts in a unique account of how Trust, people and places helped to bring about the freedoms that we enjoy today. For the full story, please do listen from episode one. Last time we heard how the success of the militant suffragette campaign and the political might of Lord Curzon and Countess Jersey's National League for Opposing Women's Suffrage had threatened to overshadow the moderate suffragist movement. This time we'll hear how catastrophic events in 1914 are about to change women's roles within society and how the decision about female suffrage will rest in the hands of one of the Trust's key figures. I'm Kirsty Wark, and this is Women and Power, a podcast from the National Trust. By 1914, suffragette militancy has reached its highest level since the start of their campaign. Although the aim of the suffragettes is to cause disruption through damage to property and attacks on the postal service, their methods increasingly include harassment, bombings, and arson. Here's Sophie Duncan, Junior Dean of Arts at the University of Oxford.
To my mind, there is no doubt that the suffragettes were acting in a way that would absolutely fit our contemporary definition of terrorism. You know, they were perpetrating acts of violence that had the potential to harm and indeed to kill ordinary members of the public. If the suffragettes didn't actually kill anybody except themselves, that was more by luck than judgment. For example, there were attacks on Lloyd George's new villa. As it happened, there were workmen inside when an explosive device went off. They weren't hurt, but the suffragettes had no way of knowing that wouldn't happen. The fact is, they weren't that good at making explosives, but I think they would have got better.
Although there are no reported deaths or injuries caused by the suffragettes, the women themselves are taking casualties, including the very public death of Emily Davison beneath the hooves of the King's Horse at the Epsom Derby, and hundreds of women subject to the mental and physical effects of force feeding. As the suffragette militancy is intensifying, the government's response is becoming more extreme. Something has to happen to ease the tension. However, when that something comes along, it is in the most devastating form.
Darling.
What is it?
Come here.
I'm just in the middle of this.
Come quickly, look here, the newspaper.
In August 1914, millions of Britons opened their newspapers to see their worst fears realised.
His Majesty's government declared to the German government that a state of war exists between Great Britain and Germany as from 11 p.m.
The declaration of war marks a change in the relationship between the suffragettes and the government, as Elaine de Vries, operations director at the Pankhurst Centre, explains.
The authorities used Emmeline's influence and power to get behind the war effort. And all of a sudden she was useful to them. She was a national figurehead. Women listened to what she said. Women, get behind the men, get behind this war effort. Go into the factories, work, knit, support. You know, people had a feeling that the troops should be helped and that the war effort was a just cause.
Women rally behind the war effort and start to fill the vacancies left by fighting men. Women have always been an important part of the workforce, but the roles they're now taking on make them more visible than ever before. It broadens their horizons and gives them access to communities previously closed to them. Liz Robertson, the centenary officer at the Imperial War Museum, explains more.
You've got your very traditional images of women working in munitions factories, making shells. We have some wonderful photographs of kind of factory scenes, farming scenes, office scenes of the Foreign and Commonwealth Office newsroom. And you've got a woman just sat there alongside men, just working entirely together alongside each other, taking notes, writing down from news reports. And it was very much a time at which women took roles in which they were on a par with men.
To help the war effort, one option many women choose is to join the Voluntary Aid Detachment, more commonly known as the VAD. Here's Alistair Brooks, Heritage Manager at the British Red Cross.
The VADs weren't just nurses, they encompassed ambulance drivers and cooks and cleaners, but indeed the most iconic role they took on was nursing. We had slightly over 90,000 VADs volunteering with the British Red Cross in the First World War. Two-thirds of the VADs were women.
Two VAD nurses with a connection to the Trust are Madge and Helen Gregg. Speaking from a rainy quarry bank, Ruth Colton, Research Associate at the University of Manchester, tells us more.
So we're here in the Glass House at the part of the Lost Voices exhibition, which features Madge and Helen Gregg. They were the great-granddaughters of Samuel and Hannah Gregg. They would have grown up and played in these gardens, looking down on the mill. Madge and Helen both became Voluntary Aid Detachment nurses during the First World War. Madge Gregg was the elder of the two sisters, and she first went to the front line as an ambulance driver.
When the First World War broke out, the majority of ambulance drivers with the British Red Cross were men. It was considered to be a male role. But as the First World War continued, the level of casualties was such that there were fewer and fewer men available to drive the ambulances, and women began to take over those roles.
Usually when we think about the front line, we're thinking about men who are fighting on the battles. But actually, a lot of the women were out there as well, and they often came under bombardment as well.
The ambulance drivers would most likely have been the VADs exposed to enemy action most frequently. Quite difficult conditions that are unimaginable to us sitting here. Gunshot wounds, munitions, artillery wounds, gas injuries.
Madge rises quickly through the ranks and is soon running her own field hospital just behind the Allied front line. Later, her sister Helen joins her in the rigorous and relentless work.
Both Madge and Helen mark how they didn't even get time off when their two older brothers were killed in action. They didn't receive time off in order to grieve or in order to go and see them.
When the sisters do get some precious time to themselves, they spend it drawing and writing in their journals. Here's the National Trust's Emma Richmond.
We also have some of Madge's diary entries on display as part of the exhibition. The page we've got displayed is some of her illustrations from her time at Dunkirk. And we also have some recollections from Helen's children about their mother and also about their Aunt Madge. There are some recollections here that talks about how the horrors of the war affected Helen as a nurse. We think of soldiers in the First World War having what we would now call post-traumatic stress disorder, what at the time they referred to as shell shock. But you can see here that it affected women as well. The recollection says, "My mother didn't talk about the war. It was tough. Madge lived until she was 100 and had nightmares about the war when she got old, shouting. My father also had nightmares and screamed at night."
The war is a great leveller, and VAD volunteers come from all walks of life, the working, middle and upper classes, and even royalty. Hannah Squire, conservation assistant at Whittick Manor, explains the Mandar family's royal suffrage connection.
Princess Sadira was an Indian princess, and she married Geoffrey's brother, Alan. And Sadira Mandar was very much part of the Red Cross during the First World War. She was awarded certificates for her activism. She also campaigned for Indian women's rights to vote. And she was very friendly with Princess Sophia, who was known as the only British Asian suffragette.
Princess Sophia may be one of the best connected VAD nurses and suffragette campaigners.
Princess Safia Duleep Singh was the daughter of the last Maharaja of independent Punjab, the goddaughter of Queen Victoria, an acquaintance and friend of the Pankhurst sisters, a very prominent suffragette in her own right. She would infuriate George V by standing outside her grace and favour residence at Hampton Court Palace and handing out suffragette newspapers.
The months spent in the gruelling, traumatic and pressured conditions of a war zone has an unexpected consequence for some when they return home. Here's Ruth Calton again.
When Madge returned from the war, she was able to go off and study to become a doctor, and her experiences as a nurse during the war actually enabled her to enter the classes alongside the men without doing the pre-training that would have been required. She was able to train as a doctor, and she became one of the first female orthopaedic surgeons in the country. So this career progression was sort of made possible by the experience of the war. What this meant for them was that they lived a life which was really different to the sort of life that middle-class or upper-class women, like they were, would have experienced in any other time.
With all sections of society pooling together and making sacrifices for the war effort, Parliament takes another look at who should be eligible to vote. The Representation of the People Act of 1918, which will grant the right for women to vote for the first time, is put in front of the House of Commons and sails through with little resistance. Here's Daniel Atherton, project curator at Kedleston Hall, former home of anti-female suffrage campaigner Lord Curzon.
A very strong influence on the way that politicians voted on the Representation of the People Act was the ongoing First World War and the activities of women within the First World War. This argument that society would collapse if women changed their roles and acted in the traditional forms of men, then society would collapse. The absolute opposite had happened.
Here's Oxford's Sophie Duncan again.
The line that we often hear is that the suffragettes turned from militancy to war work and a grateful nation saw what plucky women could do and gave them the vote. I think the truth is a lot messier than that. What happens is, during the war, it strikes people as increasingly unfair that there are plenty of men in the army who are able to die for their country, but not to vote for it. And it is established that a piece of legislation is going to be brought in to expand male suffrage. At this point, many suffragists, as well as suffragettes, are taking leading volunteer roles, and they petition the government saying, you cannot expand male suffrage without including women in that. Other factors that have changed the perception of women's roles is that many women have become the heads of their families for the first time while men are away. So you have women taking financial responsibility and practical responsibility for the household in a more visible way. Women are performing important volunteer work, absolutely. But there's also been a sea change in Parliament. So in 1916, we have a new Prime Minister who is more pro-suffrage than his predecessor. And that generation of Liberal politicians who were the junior ministers before the war are now achieving seniority. Some of them are decorated war heroes themselves. They are more pro-suffrage, and their moment has come.
Before the Representation of the People Act can become law, it has to pass through the House of Lords. Here, the question of female suffrage causes concern.
An amendment was opposed in which the element of the Representation of the People Act, which would offer votes for women, was removed. So the House of Lords debated that amendment, and it was expected, really, that they would support it and effectively block votes for women. At this time, Curzon was the president of the National League proposing women's suffrage and the leader of the House of Lords, so he was perfectly positioned to block the vote.
The addition of female suffrage to the Representation of the People Act has also not gone unnoticed by the women of the National League for opposing women's suffrage. But with Curzon on side, they know they have the right connections to block or delay its inclusion. Countess Jersey of the Trust's Austerlitz House and Mary Humphrey Ward, two of the National League's highest ranking women, spring into action,
petitioning him almost daily in letters to gain reassurance that he would defend their cause, and Curzon promised to do so.
In January 1918, the inclusion of female suffrage is discussed in the Lords and goes into extra debate. There is still no conclusion after 2 days. People are irritated and frustrated, and Lord Curzon seizes the moment to influence the crowd.
Curzon stood up and precursed his speech by saying that he was going to speak as an individual.
I personally remain unconvinced that it is either fair or desirable or wise in the manner that is proposed to add 6 million female voters to the electorate of this country. And I may, in order to vindicate my own position, state briefly the reasons which lead me to continue to hold that view. In the first place, as many speakers have pointed out, this is a vast and incalculable, almost catastrophic change, which, whatever be your views about it, is without precedent in history and without justification in experience.
In the Lords, the gallery is packed with female members of the National League, and they wait eagerly to hear what Lord Curzon will say next.
Just before he concluded, he then stated that he was going to speak as a member of the House of Lords.
What he says shocks many of those in the gallery.
If I desired to offer a prophecy, I would say that before many years are past, insofar as women act together, the influence which you are about to throw into the distribution of power in the state will not be a conservative influence, but will be a socialist influence, and very likely a disturbing influence in the life of this country. I cannot vote either way upon this amendment. For I am loath to assume the responsibility of embarking upon a course which I might not be able to pursue.
He declares that he's going to abstain from the vote, and he advises that other members of the House of Lords do the same. Immediately after his speech, the amendment does go to a vote, and over 50% of the House of Lords abstains. As a result of that abstention, it's then passed, and effectively the Representation of the People Act is allowed to pass into law. The women of the National League were far from impressed, and the anger was apparently audible in the galleries from where the women were watching.
Countess of Jersey, on the other hand, had a more measured response to the news. Judith Evans in the Long Gallery at Austerley House.
I think Countess Jersey, given her social standing, probably was more in the know than a lot of them, especially given the circle she was running in, as we know from the parties, and probably was more aware of what was happening than possibly the rest of the group. I can't imagine that she was particularly thrilled that it sort of glided by, but I think she probably understood the reasoning behind.
Even so, within a month, an executive committee is called and Lord Curzon is voted out of his position as president of the National League. While on the surface, for Lord Curzon, this may seem like an odd move, on closer examination, it looks a lot more like a shrewd political manoeuvre.
He recognised that if the House of Lords were to block a vote that had been so heavily voted in favour of in the House of Commons, it could cause a political crisis. And you have to remember that this is in early 1918, the First World War is ongoing, so Britain simply couldn't afford such an event to happen.
On the 6th of February 1918, the Representation of the People Act comes into law. At last, for the first time, it's possible for women to vote in parliamentary elections.
Many suffragettes describe it as the greatest night of my life, the happiest moment of my life. There is huge joy for women who've been involved in the movement.
There was jubilation because it was the first time any woman had the vote.
There were mixed feelings. And people were jubilant and a tiny little bit surprised, I think, as well, because it had been so near. But, of course, it was only some women and a lot of people felt it should be all women.
Obviously, there's disappointment at the scope of the bill. And for the next 10 years, you know, agitation continues to bring women's right to the vote in line with men's.
Although women would be eligible to vote in the next general election, this was only a partial victory for the suffrage movement. Voting rights were only extended to a small portion of society that satisfied age, property, or marital criteria. It would be another decade before suffrage was extended to all. In the next and final episode of Women and Power, we explore the political and strategic reasons for limiting the female vote and the consequences for those living in trust-managed properties. We also take a look at how, beyond 1918, trust figures continue to play their part in the campaign for full equality between men and women in the UK. Women in Power is more than just a podcast. To celebrate the centenary of the Representation of the People Act, the National Trust is running a year-long programme of talks, exhibitions and installations, as well as publishing guidebooks and online articles. To learn more about the National Trust's Women and Power programme, go to nationaltrust.org.uk/womenandpower. And to learn more about the Trust locations featured in this episode, type Kedleston, Austerley House, Quarry Bank or Whittock Manor into the search bar of our website, nationaltrust.org.uk. Make sure you don't miss next week's final episode by subscribing on Apple Podcasts or wherever you find great audio. While you're there, you might also enjoy episodes of the National Trust flagship audio programme, the National Trust Podcast. To find out more about podcasts at the Trust, go to nationaltrust.org.uk/podcasts.